Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast, where snacks are delicious.
Just snacks in general.
Well, everyone likes snacks. Your favorite snacks. Not the snacks you don't like. The ones you do. Anyway.
I was off snacking. I just started snacking again on Sunday.
Oh, there you go. That was a choice.
It was a choice.
Yeah, there you go.
A choice I made. I was off snacks.
There you go.
Lost a lot of weight.
Oh, you look great.
It turns out, yeah, I graze an awful lot. It's difficult to get off once you start.
Well, that's why I have an assortment of snacks here for you.
There are many snacks nearby. Yeah. It's really rather pleasant.
Yeah, I like having a lot of snacks. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic, and I am surrounded by snacks.
Yeah, and I want to give everyone a quick update. Some people may have noticed that we've had a few fewer podcasts lately, in the last couple of weeks, and there's been some stuff going on. I alluded to it in a previous podcast. I didn't want to say anything until I knew for a fact what was happening, but long story short, and don't worry, there's a happy ending to this. I had a cancer scare, specifically a skin cancer scare. It's all fine. I actually had what is called basal cell skin cancer, which is the kind that is the one, if you're going to have it, you want to have that one.
Yeah.
That's the good one. They it's not good, but it's...
They were kind enough to name it after a nice herb.
Yeah. So I got my latest biopsy back. They got all of it. It's fine. But I wanted to use this opportunity to remind everybody, especially if you're a little older, if you have any particular moles or anything that might look a little odd to you, go see a dermatologist. It's not scary, even in a rough situation. You're in and out really, really quick. And they treated me really, really great. And it's all okay now. I just have to go to the dermatologist more often to keep an eye on things. So I want to give everyone a quick reminder in case you hadn't in a while or you've been putting it off. Take it from me. Don't put it off. Yeah. But in any case, I'm fine. Thank you for everybody who expressed some concerns when I vaguely alluded to it previously. That's what's been happening with me. It's been a little distracting of, you know, I'm a hypochondriac in general, so there was some despair going on. But fortunately, I have good friends like Whitney and Michelle, of course. My partner has been absolutely wonderful. And yeah, it turns out not that big a deal, but there was a brief scare. Anyway, we get to talk about movies now. Thank God. Something
we can get our heads around.
Something super pleasant. I sure hope that there's a really fun, big budget blockbuster in theaters this last weekend that we can all enjoy, which has no problematic elements.
There is a big budget blockbuster in theaters this weekend.
Uh-huh. I like the start of this.
Yeah, it's the 11th film in a long-running beloved series.
Oh, that's encouraging. That's encouraging. Okay, now tell me more.
It started out as a fanciful world about children wizards going to a boarding school.
You have lost
me. And it was all very delightful and magical, and then it got muddy and miserable, and it became all about like war and conspiracies.
Yeah.
And then they stopped that series and started an even more miserable series, and we're three films into that series now.
Yeah, this is Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore. Boy, Harry Potter, okay, there have been a number of significant, coincidentally, I think, fantasy franchises, where they were on top of the world, everyone loved them, everyone was talking about them for a really long time, and then in the relatively recent future, mistakes were made, and now to some people, they are anathema.
Well,
like Game of Thrones was like riding high, was everyone's favorite thing in the world. One bad last season. It was a really bad last season. Everyone's just like, no, fuck it, it was never good in the first place.
I think Star Wars, Harry Potter, and The Hobbit all had, I guess, Lord of the Rings, all had a very specific arc where they were riding really high with like a big series of like interconnected movies that everybody really liked. Those first three Star Wars theatrically released feature films were
the biggest thing ever.
Yeah, people started referring to them as the trilogy. And then they made three Lord of the Rings movies, and they were 12 hours apiece, and they just lasted forever, and there's gigantic productions.
Won a ton of Oscars. They're a big deal, yeah.
And Harry Potter. There were 8 of those. They're just a big old hunk of those
things.
They
made huge amounts of money. They were inspiring to a whole generation of kids.
And all of those series wrapped up. They're fine. We're done. Yeah. I guess there could have been a 4th Star Wars film. There was no reason to stop where they did, but they did.
They did. But they just had to keep going, didn't they?
But then they had to keep going. It's like, how can we milk this a little bit more? Well, so they said, well, the story's finished.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Potter went to Broadway. Little bit of an adjunct.
Had a play. That's an interesting choice. Interesting. Yeah, I still haven't seen it. I have no idea if that's any good or not, but interesting choice.
Star Wars had some TV shows.
Well, it went fallow for a while, and then it came back for the prequels, which were successful, but had mixed success.
Well, what I was going to get to is the only way they could go back is to make prequels. They had to tell the story before the story. Mm-hmm. So we had Star Wars The Phantom Menace.
Mm-hmm.
We had The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. And we had Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
Ah, I see.
And they all suck.
Yeah. Well, I will say this. The Hobbit would have been good as one film.
Yes.
Maybe two. If you really want to milk it, maybe two. Stretching that sucker out to three.
Three long movies, you did not have the
hour and a half animated movie gives you the entire book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I understand if you want to pad it a little bit, but you don't need that much time.
They cut out the werebear. There's like a bear man in the book.
They cut out a few things, but like basically the whole book is there. You don't really need a 9-hour epic to tell The Hobbit. The Hobbit is the prequel. The Hobbit is the one quick chapter before everything gets started. It's the prologue.
And it's also like kind of quaint and adorable. Yeah. It's not about gigantic action.
Yeah.
There is a war at the end of the book, but the whole point is that the Hobbit is like, I don't understand war. In the book, he gets knocked out.
Yeah, in the book, he's unconscious. We don't see the war. And the whole point is
he just wanders away and lets them fight and doesn't get involved at all.
No, eventually he says he got hit on the head and missed it. But like, regardless, the point is war is stupid and we shouldn't be celebrating war. And and when they made the trilogy, they made the last like 2 hours all awesome war shit, which is just the exact opposite of the point. Star Wars, they had more freedom. That was George Lucas's original idea. He could do whatever he wanted with it. Some of it had been alluded to, whatever. But like when it came time to do Harry Potter, and I feel like we got a little in the weeds here. Let's focus on Harry Potter for a second. Harry Potter had that enormously successful original series, stretched out the last book to 2 movies. Don't really think they needed to, but they made that choice. And then that was kind of it. They did a Broadway play. People seemed to like that. And then they're like, well, what else can we do? And J.K. Rowling had the idea to take a character who had been mentioned in the original series, Newt Scamander. He wrote a textbook that they use at Hogwarts. A textbook which implied that he had done interesting things called Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And said, what if I did a movie series about that guy? And on paper, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, that could be cool. Yeah, let's go explore some different corners of the magical world. Let's talk about some Fantastic Beasts. And then it just couldn't focus on that. We had to make it all about wizarding politics and the prequel ship for Dumbledore. Yeah. And we just had to make it more complicated. We had to make it more connective tissue with the original series, even things that didn't make any goddamn sense. And it just became this giant mess of unfocused stuff.
I'm not a big fan of any of the films that David Yates made for this series, which is going on 8 of them now. Five, six, seven, eight, and then one. So
he's
done 7 of them.
Yeah. Which is just an astounding. He's been doing that for over 10 years.
This has been sort of his main gig. In there, he did a Tarzan movie, which I also didn't like.
No, it's not great.
And I feel like, I don't like the way he shoots his movies. I was actually looking up if he works with the same cinematographer each time. It's a different cinematographer each time, and yet somehow he's managed to give instructions to each one of his cinematographers. Some of them are like have long careers and are very skilled photographers. To make everything look a little bit hazy and indistinct.
Yeah.
There's no natural light in his movies. It's all very, like, gray and shadowy. Whenever there's a shot of the sky, it's always covered with clouds or even CGI clouds.
Yeah.
And everything looks really kind of drab and indistinct. That's been a problem throughout his entire Harry Potter run. And that goes into this new Fantastic Beasts film as well.
Yeah.
And as well, he seems to have lost the thread on an important element of storytelling, and that's just a basic amount of clarity.
Mm, yeah.
I understand that these Harry Potter movies were based on books when it comes to the actual Harry Potter
movies. And they were best-selling books. There was some understanding that the people in the audience, a lot of them would have read the books.
So there was a lot of effort to bring key moments into the movies and give them a lot of gravitas. Because everything was important to the reader. They wanted to see everything just
all
the
minutiae.
And when you do that, though, you miss like pacing and cinematic storytelling.
And sometimes I feel like those movies, especially the Harry Potter ones, took for granted what the audience knew and kind of forgot to tell a story that works in the film.
Yeah.
Case in point, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. Over the course of the book...
Over the
course of the movie, Harry Potter has a textbook that has notes from someone who refers to himself as the Half-Blood Prince. And he uses those notes to get better grades in his classes. Okay. At the end of the movie, Snape tells him, "I was the Half-Blood Prince." At no point does the movie explain what that means or refers to.
What a Half-Blood Prince is.
Why is he a Half-Blood... Is he royalty? Whatever. The book makes it clear. The book establishes that. It's just basically, and this was an important moment in the book, and we will do none of the context that makes it have any significance whatsoever. I said good day to you, sir. So he, for me, always feels like he's just kind of like doing the Cliff's Notes of a lot of the stories. But with Fantastic Beasts, he had the opportunity to tell these stories from scratch, and I was hoping maybe they would have some sense of wonder and some sense of... majesty as we're introducing new characters and new ideas. And I feel like we only had that in a couple of moments.
I think what happened was because those 5, 6, 7, and 8 of the Harry Potter movies were all massive hits. They were big moneymakers.
Oh, yeah.
And they made the same mistake as those Pirates of the Caribbean movies. Those movies were like really kind of dense and convoluted and didn't make a whole lot of sense unless you had read the books. And I think the filmmakers...
Not Pirates, Harry Potter.
Both, actually.
But Harry Potter, Pirates wasn't based on books.
No, but they're both like
dense and convoluted.
Dense and overcrowded and convoluted.
Especially after
the first one. The filmmakers assumed that's what the audience wanted, was dense and convoluted. So when it came time to make these Fantastic Beasts movies, not based on books, inspired by characters from the books, but you can now make a movie of this, that you weren't beholden to certain moments any longer.
No.
But they still told them in the same way with that dense, convoluted storytelling.
Which is weird.
A lot of these moments are given a lot of gravitas, but we didn't have any connection to those moments
anymore. What's weird about it is that if you look at the original Harry Potter movie, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone or Sorcerer's Stone, depending on where you were and when it was released, the original Harry Potter, by the way, the book is super short. Like, the later ones are, like, these gigantic,
like 800
you know, like,
books,
Dickensian giant novels. And then, but the first one's, like, a little pamphlet. The first one's, like, totally a kid's book. The first movie is really simple. The first movie is a very simple, straightforward, wish-fulfillment fantasy for kids who feel downtrodden. That's it. That's the whole fucking thing. Harry Potter finds out his shitty childhood is not his destiny, and in fact, he actually is going to be part of this magical world of wonder. He meets some cool people. He has a couple of quick one-off adventures. He stops a bad guy at the end, and everything goes his way. That's it. It introduces you to everything in a very clean, very simple, but very effective way. Fantastic Beasts never had that. It was always just jammed you right into this really big, giant, convoluted world. And I feel like they never had... I don't know if it's if they had too much confidence in their material or not enough. I honestly don't know. Because we really didn't get to know most of these characters very well. And then we just kind of got shoved them into bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger stories. And that's not even getting into the other elephant in the room. Which is J.K. Rowling.
Being a horrible person.
J.K. Rowling has turned into what is known as a TERF. A trans-exclusionary radical feminist. Someone who believes that in order to help women, you have to push down people who are trans.
Trans women. Yeah.
That is fucked up.
It's fucked up, and it's not a case of her saying some ignorant shit and then being corrected.
Yeah, I realized I was wrong, you know, that kind of thing, yeah, no.
She continued to press.
Double down.
And continued to press.
Still does.
And when she was told, "You're wrong about this," she continued to press. She wrote a book about it. She wrote a novel. Pressing into a lot of these media-fed fears about what trans people. What novel did she write? She wrote a novel about a man who dressed as a woman so he could infiltrate women's spaces and murder them.
What the hell are you talking? What?
That was J.K. Rowling novel. Oh, it was a murder mystery
novel. All right, well, that's... So, okay, I missed that one. All right.
So, yeah, she's leaned in hard to this shit. And,
and that only...
And that has kind of tainted her legacy in a lot of ways.
Well, it tainted her legacy in a lot of ways. It's also called a lot of attention to stuff in the books that people were pretty happy to give a pass to initially. Like, the whole idea that all of the money in the Harry Potter universe is controlled by... creepy little monsters with big noses. Cool.
Yeah, it's
like a lot of caricatures that are extremely bad stereotypes.
Yeah, that's definitely a bad stereotype. That stereotype is not her doing, though. She definitely
leaned into it.
It's something that like a lot of authors, you know, even to this day, are still kind of leaning into. So that's an unfortunate stereotype that she leaned into.
Well, my point is that everyone just started taking a closer look and not liking what they saw.
There were some rumors when the books were published that the character of Albus Dumbledore, who's the headmaster at Hogwarts school.
Yeah.
It's not a university.
So no, it's for
Hogwarts,
kids.
Hogwarts School for Kids.
Yeah.
That the character might be queer. He has no romances or has any romantic talk in any of the books. But,
and indeed, in the last book, it's heavily implied that he had at least somewhat romantic relationship with another man when he was a teenager.
Yeah.
He just gave off the vibes. And then later on, J.K. Rowling said in interviews, never in print, that Dumbledore is gay, or at least he's supposed to be. And some people were like, "Oh, that's cool." And other people were like, "Well, why can't we put that
in the book?
Yeah. Why can't we have actual representation and maybe like put that in there so people realize that this is okay and that there's actually like a whole world of heroes who are actually diverse in Harry Potter? And wouldn't that be nice?"
So yeah, this little after the fact stuff was a little limp. It didn't. That's not representation.
No.
It's like, oh, you can read this book. Now you can pretend that character is gay or straight or whatever you want. It's like, well, that's not representation.
No. Which brings us to this movie.
It brings us to this movie. It's called The Secrets of Dumbledore. And in this one, there are several lines of dialogue throughout and a rather penetrating moment in the climax where his romance with the character of Grindelwald, played by Mads Mikkelsen in this movie, is key.
Yeah. In fact, it is explicitly stated that Dumbledore was in love with Grindelwald, and their relationship is a central part of the film. It is worth noting that they did that, finally, after all this time. It is also worth noting that they did it in such a way that it could be easily edited out of the film for international markets, and the plot would still make sense.
The plot would still make sense. I think there's like two explicit lines of dialogue only in two different points in the movie. There's a magical widget in this movie
which we saw in one of the earlier films as well.
Dumbledore wears it around his wrist. It's like a chain, and inside is a drop of his blood and a drop of Grindelwald's blood, and it's this thing that prevents them from attacking each other.
Yeah, they've made a vow never to hurt each other, basically. Yeah.
And he says in dialogue, we made this because we were in love. We're going to take on the world together, so we made this magical thing. We could never hurt each other. And that's a pretty romantic object to own, whether or not you cut it off for story reasons.
Yeah.
It is a pity that you can make a few tactful cuts and take the queerness out of the movie, but I'd appreciate that that's actually a big part of the movie, not just something that's incidentally mentioned.
I also think it's something that we talked about maybe a little less than some of the other stuff we talked about, that the movie equates Dumbledore's only romantic relationship in history as a teenager with a brief summertime dalliance with fascism. Because he was on Grindelwald's side for a while and they actually agreed on a lot of major talking points, and Grindelwald went off and actually did all that stuff, and Dumbledore realized he was wrong.
Well, you're a young, bitter teen, and that's understandable. I understand,
but making the parallel...
It's like being...
Like, my one gay relationship was also my one closest relationship with fascism. It's sort
that's more of a youthful thing. It's like saying you're a teenage anarchist. That doesn't bother me so much.
I just think it's not... If it's the only representation we got, it's not great.
All right. The story of this movie is... okay, so this really frustrated me. There's a few introductions. We get to see a flashback with Dumbledore and Grindelwald. Mm-hmm. We get to see Newt Scamander gathering up an exotic beast, a fantastic beast.
Yes.
Which is actually going to serve an actual plot function.
It's actually really important. It is very, very important to the thing, yeah.
And then we'll get to the actual, like, beginning of the plot. Several of the main characters, some from previous movies, some I think are new, are gathered on a train. And they say, okay, we're all gathered, we're the good guys, and we're going to take on Grindelwald, who is an evil wizard who wants to kill humans because he can foresee the future. He's seen that this takes place in the 1920s. He's seen that World War II is coming. Mm. These humans are going to make a bomb. We got to kill them before they start killing everybody.
Yeah, Grindelwald wants to stop World War II.
Yeah.
A plot point which is never mentioned in this film. At the end of the last movie, they say, yeah, we need to all band together as wizards because humans are going to do a World War II. Mm. And then this movie never brings that up again.
Well, now it's Grindelwald's plan is, in order to carry out his plot to wipe out humanity, is, and I don't really quite understand this, become wizard president.
Yeah.
There's an election coming up for, ruler of all world wizardom.
Yeah, the ruler of the world. The wizards actually have an election to decide who's going to rule the world. Mm. This was never mentioned in the Harry Potter books, by the way, which it feels like a kind of thing that it wouldn't be important. By the way, there's a leader of the world.
Mm. his plot to do so is he's going to gather all the wizards together. He's going to get this magical beast that we saw in the intro.
Chillin.
Because it's chillin' like a villain. Chillin' for a villain.
Hmm.
And he is going to kill it.
Yeah.
But then resurrect it, like, through necromancy.
Yeah, he's going to zombify. It's basically Bambi, but it looks a little weird.
Yeah, it's this kind of, this like reptilian deer creature.
So at the beginning of the movie.
And it's a fawn, and if he can get that fawn to bow to him at a key moment, he will be accepted as wizard president.
Because those fawns only bow to people who are truly pure of heart.
Mm.
And,
but he has a zombie fawn that he can force to bow for him.
Okay, so you know, like, in the movie Bambi, when, like, Bambi's mom dies and it's, like, the saddest thing ever? That happens, like, twice in the first 15 minutes of this movie. It's something, like, really traumatic and horrible happening to, like, a sweet, innocent animal. Like, it's really dark.
Mm.
But yeah, that's the idea, is he's going to manipulate himself so that he can become potentially elected president of Earth, and because he's got a bad reputation, what with all the terrorism, he's going to get this this magic zombie fawn to say, yeah, he's cool. Mm. And then everyone's going to be like, oh, well, if the magic zombie fawn
says yes, they don't know
it's a zombie, but if the magic fawn says yes... Boom. I love the way that they vote for wizard president because they shoot a color up in the air with their magic wand. This was the red presidential candidate. This is the green one. This is the blue one. And you shoot them way up in the air and they'll all just say, well, that's mostly red. And I'm like, what if it's close? What if it's like, we've all known close elections happen. Like, what if it's like down to like a couple of votes? Who's counting that? How does that work?
The aggravating thing is, once all the good guys want to stop this from happening, they know...
As they would.
And now, because they know Grindelwald can see the future, they've gathered them all up. We have Newt Scamander, that's Eddie Redmayne. He's been the main character of the last two movies.
And
he's not anymore. He's just part of a group. There's a few other side characters who are all new. There's his brother
we saw before.
Did we see his brother before?
Yeah, he was important. It wasn't like kind of a huge role, but he was in the last one. We have his brother... We have Dan Fogler is back.
As the American human baker. He's not a wizard.
Honestly, he's the best part of this whole series. He's so damn good.
He's the only one who brings any actual humanity because he's the only human. I'm learning that wizards don't behave like humans.
Well, that was actually kind of important in the books, and the movies kind of lost sight of that and made them more human-y in terms of their like culture and society. But
In one of the movies, a wizard dad says, hey, Harry Potter, you lived with all of these non-magic people.
Yeah.
Like, I live in the wizard world and everything's different here.
Yeah.
I don't interact with humans at all.
Yeah.
So, and the question is, what is the purpose of a rubber duck? Because this is an alien object to him.
In the books, wizards don't wear pants. They always wear robes. Like, always wear robes. And in the third movie, Alfonso Cuarón was just like, that's stupid and I don't like that. So he just had them do that. But then we still had two movies where they did. It just doesn't fit anymore. You kind of just created this continuity here.
I like the robes, though. They're wizards. They should wear robes.
I don't disagree, but whatever. The movies made their choices. But, anyway, so there's them. You got a new character played by, is it Jessica Williams? She recruits Dan Fogler.
Oh, I don't
from
know.
The Daily Show.
Oh yeah, I don't know. I like the character. Yeah. She's like this wizard recruiter who brings Dan Fogler into the fold.
Yeah, it's Jessica Williams.
Jessica Williams.
All right. She's, I think she's new, but at least completely new. We have Newt Scamander's a personal assistant who I think was in the last one but didn't have a major role.
Yeah, and she's named Pepper Potts
notably,
or something.
Notably absent is Catherine Waterston, who was the second lead in the first two films.
And was kind of a romantic interest for the Eddie Redmayne
She
character.
Was a romantic interest for the Eddie Redmayne character.
From what I understand, Catherine Waterston, the actress, just didn't want to be associated with J.K. Rowling anymore.
Yeah, and that she actually put her foot down and said that what she's doing isn't cool. And as a result, her character is in the movie for about 45 seconds, and I'm pretty sure some of it's CGI or reused footage.
There's one shot of her in a crowd, and then there's like three lines later in the movie.
Yeah.
And then there's Dumbledore himself, and he's played by Jude Law.
Yeah.
They gather in a train, this little ragtag band. They say, we got to stop this guy, but he can see the future. So we have to do the Confuse-a-Cat Limited thing. We just have to do a bunch of random shit, and that way he'll never see us coming. If he has foresight, he'll not know what we're up to.
Now, in screenwriting terms, when you're a writer and you give yourself an idea like that, so basically what we have to do is a bunch of random confusing stuff to distract the villain. What you're basically saying is, we wrote a bunch of random confusing stuff and we want it all to make sense in retrospect.
No way of connecting at all. So there are a lot of disconnected set pieces where I don't know where they are.
Yep.
I don't know what the function of that place is.
Yep.
I don't know why they went there.
Yep.
But there's a lot of tense stuff going on there.
Yeah. There's a whole scene where Newt Scamander has to do some kind of weird prison breakout where he has to do interpretive dance with scorpion spiders.
Yeah, they're...
I don't remember why we had to do that.
They all split up. There is one character who has an actual role in this scheme where he has to infiltrate Grindelwald's inner circles.
Yeah, yeah. That actually,
I want to get into you. It's like, well, I'm a wizard. I read your thoughts, and you want vengeance because I killed your sister.
So I'm going to remove those memories.
So he puts his wand to his brain and pulls all the memories of his sister out of his brain and says, now you are my slave, kind of thing. And,
pretty evil.
Yeah, evil bad guy
good
stuff.
Evil bad guy stuff. Just,
he's Mads Mikkelsen, so he doesn't cackle, but he might as well have.
Mads Mikkelsen, I will say this. There's two people I think are really giving good in this movie. One is Dan Fogler, who, again, is just the heart and soul of this whole fucking thing. And the other is Mads Mikkelsen, who could do this shit in his sleep.
Yeah,
he just you want smarmy, sensual... quiet bad guy. Mads will do that. He'll be great.
He's kind of a go-to. I feel like when he's a go-to for heavies, he's always giving his all, but his characters aren't necessarily interesting on the page.
That's how I feel about Doctor Strange. He's good in it, but who cares?
He was in a Thor movie or Doctor Strange or something.
Doctor Strange. Yeah, but seriously, no one remembers that bad guy. He's not a very interesting bad guy. He's just interesting because Mads Mikkelsen's playing him.
But that sequence is where Eddie Redmayne, his brother... has somehow found himself in this oubliette.
Yeah.
This, spiral-carved tube of earth.
Yeah.
And it's very dimly lit, so it's hard to see things. And you go in with a lantern that's powered by, a little lightning bug. And if your lantern goes out, you are attacked by a 100-foot scorpion that lives at the bottom of the pit.
Right. Not a great system for prison maintenance.
And... I don't know if he was arrested or how he got into that prison.
It's very confusing.
I kind of missed it.
It's very confusing.
But it's this big dirt pit, but it also has a check-in desk.
Yeah.
Which is really bizarre. There's one guy there who just with a bunch of cubbies behind him is I gotta take those critters and your magic wand. You can't go in there with that stuff. And he can just go in there and talk to prisoners face to face.
Yeah.
It's also infested with those little scorpion things. And he figures out that... if he dances, they'll mimic his dance moves.
Yeah, which is
amusing.
Maybe the only genuinely whimsical, oh, what a fanciful idea.
Yeah.
Kind of thing I can remember from this film.
Dance away the scorpions. That's kind of fun. And then there's a lot of scenes in fancy dining halls and
where wizard politics is happening.
Yeah, and there's a lot of plates and dishes floating around. And Dan Fogler has to pose or at least try to look like he's going to assassinate Grindelwald so he can be arrested for some plot function that I wasn't able to discern?
No, he did that by accident. They gave him a wand so that he'd fit in. It doesn't work.
It just
gives him something to look at that he fits in. He's in love with a woman named Queenie, who at the end of the last movie decided to team up with Grindelwald. And in the first scene she's in this movie, she already regrets it. Mm-hmm. So that entire plot point kind of goes nowhere. Also, Ezra Miller is in it. Remember Ezra Miller? Mm-hmm. He wants to kill Dumbledore because we found out he's Dumbledore. And that will be dealt with in about a scene and a half.
And it's a weird psychedelic thing where they like go into pocket dimensions and have fights that aren't taking place in reality.
It's very Doctor Strange, actually.
It was another conceit of Doctor Strange. We can have all the destruction we want if it's not real. And the whole conceit in the first Fantastic Beasts movie was that this Ezra Miller character was like the most destructive wizard of all time. And he like blew up a mountain or something.
Potentially very, very, very dangerous. Yeah.
And here he's just this supporting character in the bad guy's retinue.
Yeah. Here's what allegedly has happened behind the scenes, and I could have told you this if you hadn't told me this. Warner Brothers is starting to worry about the popularity of this franchise waning, so they decided to make this film in such a way that if this is the last one, it kind of feels like it. And it does. Yeah, they race through the Ezra Miller stuff. They drop as many plot lines as they possibly can. It has kind of like a mega happy ending for everyone who gets out of it, so that it feels kind of like, we got to this point. Everything is more or less resolved. If they wanted to continue it, they could. There's enough pieces left over. But this doesn't have that usual feeling where, there's still one thing that's going to happen in the future. Like, Voldemort's still out there or something like that. No, everything's weirdly rushed and wrapped up. And again, we've talked a lot about the context surrounding this thing. And even if that wasn't a thing, even if J.K. Rowling hadn't said any of that stuff, if this was the film that we got, it would suck. It's not a good film. There's a couple of things I like in it. There's a couple of sequences that are kind of neat.
There's an idea or two. There's a lot of interesting production design if you can see it, because the photography is awful.
I kind of like that when they go to Germany, they're clearly like right out of like a German expressionist, like industrial, weird oppressive metropolis area. That was kind of fun.
And the climax takes place in Bhutan. Because they can teleport anywhere, these wizards.
Yeah, so they
all these different spells. There's a little bit of a conceit where Newt Scamander carries a suitcase, and the suitcase is like a pocket dimension. He can climb inside. And there's like a whole zoo inside a suitcase.
I love that idea. That's a fun idea.
And even within the zoo, there's like these little miniature pocket dioramas where all of the animals can live. So there's like an entire planet worth of land
inside
a suitcase. Yeah. And that's kind of cool. I also like, when people kind of climb out of the suitcase. I think that looks really fun. There's a little conceit where they make duplicates of it and try to throw people off. There's a few scenes that take place at Hogwarts. So we get to see what the school looks like in the 1920s. It's an ancient castle. Looks the same.
It looks exactly the fucking same. Like, we don't need to be there at all. We just don't. Yeah. We don't need to go to Honeydukes. We don't need any of this.
There was a reference to cockroach clusters.
Oh, yeah.
Dan Fogler's like, oh, those kids gave me these great these candies. And he's like, oh, I don't like cockroach clusters. Cockroach cluster was a candy from Monty Python. If you remember the disgusting chocolatier.
I don't. You're right!
What's this one? Cockroach cluster, anthrax ripple.
You're right. And of course, crunchy frog.
Crunchy. The first one was crunchy frog.
Yeah.
It's like, and what's this one? Ram's bladder cup. Fresh, juicy chunks of fresh Cornish ram's bladder.
Where's the fun in that?
Emptied, steamed, flavored with sesame seeds, whipped into a fondue, and garnished with lark's vomit.
The whole point is that they're gross.
They're all really gross. Well, the joke is that the chocolatier thinks this is the most delightful thing imaginable.
Right.
And garnished with lark's vomit. That's really disgusting. Oh, no, it's wonderful.
I actually missed the Monty Python reference, so I'm glad you mentioned
it. Yeah, they made a reference to something called a cockroach cluster, which I like to think is a very direct Python reference.
Maybe one of the members of Monty Python was a wizard.
They're all wizards, weren't they?
They're all magic. Anyway, so here's the thing. It's confusing. It's rushed. if you had any investment in the storylines or characters from previous films, they don't get a lot of screen time, if any. It's momentarily entertaining in fits and starts, but it doesn't work. It doesn't work as an adventure because it's dreary and it's kind of hard to get behind any of the characters because it's just stretching itself so thin. It doesn't work as a Newt Scamander story. He's taken a back seat here. Mm-hmm. Catherine Waterston has taken a huge back seat. It doesn't really work in any meaningful way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it feels like they're just scrambling to put shit together.
It's, I don't think anybody really understands what, where the charm of this series lies anymore.
Yeah.
There's no wonderment. It's all, I guess we're supposed to be attached to these characters, and that's a big mistake that's been happening.
Yeah.
Going all the way back to something like The Empire Strikes Back, where a lot of our affection for the characters was sort of
assumed,
like carried over from your affection that they actually bothered to grow in a first film, and repeat viewings of those things sort of made your affection grow for those characters. So by the time they bring them back, your affection is now at this frenzy level, and just seeing them is supposed to get an emotional reaction.
Yeah.
Dumbledore, okay.
Dumbledore, sure. A well-known character. People like Dumbledore, yeah.
But all of these other characters are all new, and I feel like apart from Eddie Redmayne, who is actually, he's bringing it.
Yeah, I think he's playing an interesting character. He's playing an introverted action hero.
Yeah.
That's an interesting choice for a character.
He's kind and he's gentle and he's decent. He's not an action hero.
He's very quiet. He's not very outgoing. So he's very bookish. I think that's an interesting idea.
And I think Eddie Redmayne is playing that kind of a part pretty well.
Yeah.
He's not in this movie enough, and that ethos doesn't bleed into the rest of the movie. Apart from that, none of this big gaggle of characters is making any kind of impression.
Dan Fogler.
Pardon?
And Dan Fogler.
And Dan Fogler.
Dan Fogler.
And by the end of this movie, he's actually like bringing a heck of a lot of heart. And he has some sweet moments with
Queenie. There's a moment where half expect Dan Fogler to emerge as the wizard president or something. Like, it's going to be all about him. And I kind of hoped it would have been. Because here's the thing. This is the biggest problem that this series of film has had within themselves. Not the outside external circumstances. Mm. Within themselves. They never had a focus. The focus was always on too many things at once. It's never really been entirely about Newt Scamander and his animals. That would have been enough. That's enough for a movie. That's fine. We're good there. It also has to be about wizard politics. It also has to be about Ezra Miller. It also has to be about Grindelwald. It also has to be about Dumbledore. The closest thing we've had to a consistent through line has been Dan Fogler, the muggle, not a child, like a guy who's like in or approaching middle age, who's just got a good heart and just stumbled into some wizard shit. And he's always brought the right energy to that. He's always brought the right balance of sort of confusion, but also, you know, bravery. I feel like the focus of these movies probably should have been Newt and I forget the other name, Dan Fogler. Should have been those two. Those are your two. Newt brings this guy along on these adventures. Bada bing. All of this other stuff just feels, it's weird because it feels like padding and yet it is directly connected to all the previous films. So they're treating it like it's the most important stuff. It's always, for me, a distraction from the handful of characters I'm genuinely interested in and the premises that are unique to this franchise that we couldn't have had before. And as this franchise has gone on, it just became more and more like what we had before, and it never found its own identity because it never found the right focus. And I don't think they work. I think some work better than others.
Yeah.
You know, they're three films. They can't all be exactly alike. But yeah, this sucked. This is such a bummer. Like, and again, on top of everything, the shit going on around it doesn't help. Sometimes hurts the film contextually as you're looking at J.K. Rowling trying to earn bonus points for representation, given everything else going on, and in a way that can be easily cut from the film. You're just looking at it and like, okay, I can't even like watch the film now. You're distracting me with all the connections to reality that are unpleasant. Yeah, it's not a very good film.
No.
You want to talk about some horror movies?
Sure, I saw a couple of those.
Yeah, a couple of straight-to-streaming horror movies came out this week. I want to talk about, for the first one, a film with a weird, it's kind of silly premise that I ended up really digging called Choose or Die.
Formerly called Cursor. Cursor, it's a double meaning, you say.
Yeah, as in one who curses somebody, but also the cursor on your computer.
Choose or Die is a text-based adventure game from around 1983, back when computer monitors were just green.
Yeah.
And couldn't do graphics at all.
And these are if you're familiar with the era, you probably remember games like, I don't know, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or Zork. But if you're not... back before video games had what we considered graphics.
Like pictures and images.
Yeah. But they could do text very easily, and they could do simple yes and simple binary prompts, which is you agree to do this thing, it changes the story in this direction. You decide to do this thing, it takes the story in another direction. They're basically interactive novels.
The prompts would be like, you are standing in a novel, like it's always in the second person. You are in a chamber, moss drips from the wet dungeon walls. There are exits to the north and south, and there is a flask. And you type in, get flask, and it says, you cannot do that here. And then you say, go north, it says, you cannot do that here. And then you pick up your monitor and you smash it against the ground, and then you go play checkers.
Sometimes they were really weirdly complicated. There was another Netflix thing, it was from Black Mirror, called, it wasn't Jabberwocky, what was it? Bandersnatch.
Yeah,
which is kind of like this in like modern Netflix form, but basically, it's about people who find an old sort of bootleg video game from the 1980s, which is a text-based adventure, and every time you turn it on, it tells you where you are, but it's different every time you play it because it's basing it off of where you currently are right now. Mm-hmm. So, like, you are in your apartment. You are at the top of a tall tower if you're like in a skyrise or something like that. You are in a cave if you're in your man cave. And then it will give you a series of things to choose from. And very rapidly, you realize that the things that you choose from are affecting the people around you and will eventually give you an opportunity to decide the method of their demise. You might sometimes have a chance to save them. You might only be choosing how they're going to horribly die.
And then it says, choose or die.
Because if you don't choose anything, then presumably you'll die. No one ever takes that route.
I was going to say, not a single point in this movie does someone even pause to think, maybe I just won't choose and I'll die.
Yeah.
I'd rather die than kill someone.
And that's a missed opportunity, I feel, because I feel like you could have at least had a thing like, I refuse to do anything. And then maybe like, you see like their nose and ears bleed or something like that. And like, okay, fine, I'll choose. Yeah. Maybe that would have been a good idea, but...
The main character, has a sick mother.
Yeah.
And she's impoverished.
Yep. And also grieving the loss of a little brother who died in an accident not that long before the beginning of the movie.
Played by an actress named Iola Evans.
Yeah.
She is sort of investigating these old games. And she fires it up when she's in a diner and ends up, in making her decisions, forcing the waitress to do really horrible things to herself.
Yeah. And before she realizes what's going on, the waitress has already started doing something that is basically self-mutilation, and it's really, really horrifying. And by the time she realizes what's happening, it's too late.
She gets up to help this woman, and a man briefly appears out of nowhere to scream at her and then disappears again.
Yeah.
So this game can just warp reality to its own will.
Sure.
There's no fucking rules.
Not really, no. No.
there's something about trying to find the source of the game. So she teams up with her best friend, who's played by...
Asa Butterfield.
Asa Butterfield, who I think he's actually really good in this movie.
I think he is. I think he's bringing everything he needs to bring here.
And what I admire is they're best friends. He has a crush on her. He says to her that he has a crush on her, and yet they continue to be friends.
Yeah.
It's not like tension. It's not awkward. It's just like...
He's not making it weird. She just knows that if she was ever interested in him, he'd be interested in her. And other than that, they're friends and they hang out. And he doesn't like keep putting the moves on her and make it awkward.
I like their relationship.
Pretty healthy, actually.
I think Asa Butterfield is really sort of bringing a lot to this nothing role in this, quite frankly, completely stupid movie.
It's a pretty silly film.
Because the rules of this game don't make any sense.
Not especially.
They try to find the source of this. Somebody... There's a lot of good scare moments, a lot of weird sort of magical.
Basically, they have to play it every single day at the same time, so wherever they are, even if they're not near a computer console, all of a sudden a TV will tell them the game is on, or their phone will say it, and now they have to do something. Then reality is warping around them. People they know are endangered, and they only have a short amount of time to make decisions that will decide who lives and who dies, and in what horrible way that will happen. Yeah. And this leads to a series of set pieces, which mostly are pretty creepy. I mean, they're ridiculous, but I actually think they're kind of like, they deal with some very unpleasant forms of physical violence that I think are easy to like get audiences with, but they work. You know, they're stylistically, visually different every time. I appreciate that.
I was reminded of another really crappy cyber horror movie called Fear.com.
Oh, God.
Do you remember Fear.com?
I remember Fear.com.
It came out in 2002, back, you know, when the dot-com craze was like kind of booming.
Fear.com was about an evil website called Fear.com.com. Because it turned out Fear.com was a real thing, and they had already kind of made the movie, so they called it Fear.com.
The title of the film, at least, was just Fear.com.
But in the movie, it's hilarious.
It sucks you into like a tortured dimension, Fear.com. Similar physics here. There's a lot of fetishization of like old tech, but in a way, clearly made by people who have never touched that tech.
Yeah.
I'm old enough that I use that kind of stuff, and I know how inaccurate it was, and there's this, a lot of fetishization of magnetic tape and VHS cassettes. And it also borrows a conceit from Friend Request, that classic.
Oh, that there's supernatural code.
There's like witch code, the witch glyphs hidden in the code of the game, and that's why it's evil and can affect reality.
That's fun. I think that's silly. It also reminds me of this awful, awful, unbelievably bad cyber thriller called Stay Alive.
I never saw Stan.
Oh my God, it's so embarrassing. Talk about something from like people who've like never played video games before. Like, okay, we've got this game. It's called Stay Alive. It's supposed to be the best horror game ever. Okay, everyone come over and we're going to play it. And Frankie Muniz is just sitting there and he's warming up his thumbs. Like he's doing like shadow boxing with his like controller, but he has no controller just so he's ready to play that game. All of the conversations about video games in that movie make no sense whatsoever. And the premise is, however you die in the game, that's how you die in real life. This, at least Choose or Die, it's like a bootleg game. Stay Alive was supposed to be like a mass marketed game. How did they beta test that? I've never understood. Like, hey, Charlie died by falling into a spike pit in the game, but in real life he got hit by a car. We gotta fix that. That doesn't work at all. We're gonna have to burn the midnight oil to get that fixed before we submit it to Sony. Like, it's just a really stupid film.
What do you rate a game that kills people?
I mean, it does its job. I don't know. The controls work, so you kind of got to give it like a 7.
Rated T for teen.
So here I feel like they're aware that the premise is a little goofy. Here I think they're aware that, we're only here because this idea gives us an opportunity for some fun set pieces and some fun sort of ways to tell a story. There's a cute bit where they have to like drive upstate to find the investigation. They do investigate like the source of the video game. I guess budget was kind of low. So instead of filming the car ride, they made it like a video game. They like shot it like a top down.
That was kind of a cute bit. It's like Spy Hunter.
Game. That's cute. All of that stuff is, here's a movie which has a ridiculous premise, but it's being presented with a lot of energy and a lot of personality. And the cast is really fun for the most part. And some of the deaths are pretty memorable, and I enjoyed them. And I can't be mad at how silly this is, because I feel like the movie gets that it's silly.
I suppose. I just, it didn't have to be quite this silly. Eddie Marsan, the actor Eddie Marsan, an actor I really admire and has been in a lot of trash. Very talented. He was really good in the Mike Leigh film Happy Go Lucky.
Okay.
That's sort of like his moment to shine. He's worked with Mike Leigh. He's a very talented actor, but he'll show up as like a third tier villain in Deadpool 2 from time to time. Yeah, and here he plays sort of like a villainous type of a character, and I feel like even he is not given enough leeway to like really dig into any of these roles. These characters aren't that interesting.
He plays a character who is clearly, we can get a real actor for this character because we're only going to need them for 2 days.
Right.
And so it's just, if we get Eddie Marsan, cool. He's a serious actor. He'll give us some legitimacy. If we get Bruce Campbell, cool. That'll work too. If we get Chris Rock, cool. That'll, like, literally any male actor, based on the context of the story, could have played that character, basically. He's just, they were able to get Eddie Marsan that weekend. He was the one who was free. But I feel like this movie, here's how I feel like this movie, and I get your point, that it doesn't need to be this ludicrous. I feel like this is clearly like a movie that is thinking in terms of a franchise. Like, there's definitely, the premise is enough that if we get some creative filmmakers, we could keep this going for a few sequels, you know, and just do weirder, crazy, choose your, pick your poison kind of at death sequences. But I feel like tonally, they skipped Nightmare on Elm Street and went right to Freddy's Dead. That's what they did. They just skipped to like the kind of silly one where like the protagonists don't want to die, so we care whether they live or die theoretically, but everything else going on around them is absurd. Right into, honestly, clever Robert Englund cameo. The way they incorporate Robert Englund is pretty funny.
Yeah. I liked the initial conceit of the movie is they're not just sort of investigating this game because they're interested. It turns out that there's an unclaimed cash prize attached to this game that was put out into the ether back in the 1980s.
Yeah, like no one ever beat it before. But if you beat it, you get a code, you call in, you can get money. And everyone's like kind of impoverished, so they decided to go for it.
They decided to go. I like that. I like that conceit. And that's where Robert Englund comes in. You call in on this line and you hear his voice.
Yeah, someone clearly paid Robert Englund like $200 to like play the voice on the end of this video game call. And even says, hi, I'm Robert Englund.
Literally phoning in his role.
Yeah.
You're comparing this to something like Freddy's Dead. Freddy's Dead, also a pretty ridiculous movie.
Exactly.
I think it's really fun just because it's so crazy. It's got all these like weird imaginative visuals. That whole Nightmare on Elm Street film, even all those movies... even the bad ones, like Nightmare on Elm Street 5.
Five is
a pretty bad movie, but it's got a lot of crazy, weird stuff
in it. I've seen 5
it's
like 3 times. I couldn't tell you the plot of that movie.
It doesn't have a plot.
I have no idea what happens in that film. None.
It's the one where there's
there's a dream child.
The dream child.
That's it. There's a dream child, and that's not good. And then someone turns into a motorcycle, I think, and then it's over.
Somebody gets wrapped into a motorcycle. No, you forgot the scene where Freddy is like, eating people's souls and feeding them to the unborn child, and they take the form in one scene as like little sausages on a pizza, and they're like, you see the human faces on the pizza.
That's the thing that's in that movie. I forgot about that. That's how confusing that movie is.
But that's because of all of that, those weird wild visuals, at least like it's partially watchable. I'm not going to give it a pass, but we can watch the crazy scenes.
You didn't think Choose or Die was even watchable? I thought it was fun.
It wasn't crazy enough. You see something like Freddy's Dead, which has the video game sequence, and it has,
I said tonally.
A 3D sequence.
I said tonally.
All right.
Tonally, it's
there's,
on
there's, there's actually
level.
Like jokes and humor. There's not a lot of that going on in Choose or Die.
Okay, I guess I like this more than you did. For me, this was like, you know, the bar was low, but they jumped over it by a solid margin. They had some characters I actually gave a damn about. They had a premise, which was ridiculous, but they knew when to embrace it and when to just say, look, just go with it. And some of the sequences are kind of fun. It's clear that they were working on a budget, and I think they made do, honestly. I think the movie is a very entertaining watch, and if, as the movie ends and suggests that sequels could come, if there's another sequel, bring it. Maybe you could even do it better next time. Maybe you can work out the kinks. That would be great. So, I had a good time. I'm curious how you felt, since we differ on that one, about the new film on Shudder, starring Alicia Cuthbert, called The Cellar.
The Cellar.
With a C, not like the guy who's like, trying to sell you some hairbrushes door to door. Like, no, it's the basement.
Yeah, Alicia Cuthbert. I haven't seen her in a movie in a while. I first noticed her way back when she was on 24, about 20 years ago.
Played Kiefer Sutherland's daughter.
Yeah, now she's playing the mom. in The Cellar. It's an Irish horror film. Mm-hmm. This is a wonderful satanic thriller. If you've never heard of satanic thrillers before.
If you've never seen a movie where a family moves into a creepy house and then creepy stuff happens and then they research the creepy house and then more creepy stuff happens. If there's you've never seen that before, this might get you.
There's a sequence in this movie where... a family moves into a house, a house in Ireland. They bought it sight unseen. They got it at an auction.
And it's giant.
It's giant and it's furnished. It's got books in it. It's all stocked up and they move in. Young boy, he's about 10, is kind of okay with it. Teenage girl hates everything about it. Alicia Cuthbert is mom. Irish man is dad. he gets to say the skeptical stuff.
Yeah. It's all in your head.
There's a scene where, and there's like...
It's a coincidence.
There's like some glyphs and mysterious phrases sort of like inscribed in the walls. And there's like numbers.
Some Latin over here and a mathematical equation in the basement. And that's probably not good.
And it all looks really cool, actually.
It's a good house.
I love the design of the house and I love the way the glyphs look. There's a scene.
I'd live in that house. That looks awesome.
One of those little glyphs is a pentagon. Just the shape, the pentagon. It's like in the wood above a doorframe. It looks really cool. Like, nice design. And the dad looks at it, and he notices, wait a minute. If you were to put a triangle on each of these 5 points,
you create...
it would form a star. A pentagram!
Yeah, our minds have been collectively blown.
And I'll say this. The filmmakers are... doing their darndest and really succeeding in trying to make that look as shocking as possible.
They clearly know how to... they know how to tell this story. They just don't have a story.
I feel like the filmmakers are actually doing an excellent job. There is a lot of good sound design. I love the photography in this movie. I love the editing and the pacing of this movie. The initial, like... instigating incident is actually really terrifying.
Where like a teenager disappears.
That whole sequence.
She's
is
on
really
the phone
scary.
With her mom, and they're doing something. And honestly, the combination of one great way to build like suspense in a horror movie is repetition, where you're gonna do something, and every single time you do it, something happens, and you know, and you get comfortable with it. This becomes your reality. It's very difficult to establish mundanity within a horror movie, which is what you need to surprise people. Mm-hmm. If you're already on edge, anything shocking is just like, well, yeah, I expected that to happen. Mm-hmm. But if you're like at home alone for like 3 hours and nothing happens, and then all of a sudden you walk into your bedroom and there's a killer with a knife, you go, ah! Yeah,
that's scary.
So like, but you can't like get people to relax. So one way you can do that is to do something repetitious in the film so that people get comfortable with the rhythm. They find a way to do that, and then as we're going through the rhythm, and we're literally counting 1, 2, 3, and we're only going to count to 10, and then just the counting keeps going, and you're not supposed to do that, well, and there's one shot that looks a little weird, and you're not sure what that means, and that bit, admittedly, pretty creepy.
Yeah, there are a few creepy bits, like there's... something to do with like shadows and darkness, the way that the filmmakers are actually to film, like point a camera at like an empty room and there's like a shadow behind it.
Yeah.
They frame that up in such a way that it just looks scarier than in your average horror movie. There's scary stuff. That scene where she's counting, the teenage girl is like claustrophobic. She's afraid of the dark.
Yeah.
And she's locked herself at the top of the cellar stairs.
Yeah.
And it's completely dark in there, and there's a switch down at the bottom of the stairs.
Yeah.
She calls her mom and says, I'm stuck in the basement. I'm terrified. I don't know what to do.
Well, she's stuck in the basement earlier. What happens is there's a power outage while mom and dad are out.
Yeah.
And she's like, she calls her mom and says, what do I do? And she says, well, there's a circuit breaker in the basement.
And she has to go down into the dark basement.
And she doesn't want to because she got locked in there before, and it was kind of traumatic for her.
So her mom was on the phone, and her mom and her dad work as like Instagram influencers. So they're
marketers, and they're working with that. Yeah.
So they're at a meeting, and she's on the phone with her daughter and says, okay, just count each stairs. There's 10 stairs. Just count. Count each step. Okay? And, you know, as she's going, and we hear it on the other end of the phone, and when she gets to 11, you freak the fuck out. And she keeps on going, and you continue to freak the fuck out. And then when she gets home, the teenage daughter's missing.
Yeah.
And they don't know what happened.
It's a pretty creepy setup to the story, and it makes you think everything's going to be pretty creepy and stylish and effective. And unfortunately... again, the presentation's strong.
Yeah.
It looks scary. The actors are giving it their all. It's the actual content of the story. It's the actual mystery of the house. It's the actual build up to the scares. All of the investigation stuff. All of that is spectacularly unspectacular.
It's just really uncreative. Yeah. Is the problem. It's been done in a lot of satanic thrillers for decades now.
Yeah, they don't really bring their own flavor to it. They don't really bring their own...
The flavor they bring to it, and I kind of appreciated this, before they started going whole hog into, like, the satanic imagery. And it's like, oh, and look, it looks like this star. And he, like, looks in a book. Look, it looks like this star with the goat head in it. Have you ever heard of Baphomet? And then he, like, looks down in the book. It's actually Satan's. Yeah.
We get it. Seen a movie before. How have you not seen a movie before?
I bought a heavy metal record when I was 10. Yeah, how do you know what this is?
Like, everyone makes weird. There's a bit where it's like, mom is, like, looking up, and she's taking, like, a really long time to look up 3 Latin words on Google. Yeah. Like, 3. And one of them is, like, pretty much exactly what it is in English, too. So it's really weird. And then she says, hey, son of mine, when your sister disappeared, did you do anything weird? And he was like, yeah, we listened to that creepy vinyl record over there in the corner. And mom's like, cool, thanks. Then she goes back to Google, and she doesn't check the record until the next day.
Later in the movie.
Like, later in the movie. I understand wanting to finish your Google search and then go to the record. Your daughter is missing, and that might be important. We're just going to let that go? What is with this?
And... I feel like there's a lot of good individual moments. The filmmakers are capable of way more than this movie gives us. Because I was genuinely scared by a completely fallow screenplay.
Yeah.
They actually got a few moments. Just a lot of good scary moments. And there's a wonderful climax as well. Some really good visuals in the climax.
It wasn't that
great. I think there was a lot of really good sound design. There's a lot of like whispers and scratches throughout the movie. They're clearly bringing their all to a script that doesn't really deserve it.
No. And which is unfortunate because it's written and directed by the same guy.
Yeah. Good director. Maybe do somebody else's screenplay next time.
Yeah, because seriously, very, very strong direction overall, but this is a very formulaic script. It just doesn't have that... I think it's something like Sinister, which is also about house moves into creepy... family moves into creepy house... discover a creepy thing, just reaches into creepy thing. They even have a Skype call with Vincent D'Onofrio as their like guy who explains the monster to you. But they figured out, okay, we have to do something kind of distinct here. And they come up with, I find an old box of home movies that are all absolutely terrifying. And that's your in. That's the thing that makes that movie distinct. Even though otherwise it's very similar to the Amityville Horror or The Conjuring or a million other things kind of like it.
Something I appreciate, if I can link this one back to Choose or Die.
Okay.
It's been really fascinating because I grew up watching horror movies where all of this evil information was found like in the occult section in the basement of the library. Like these really rare old books.
Yeah.
Like, that was the medium from which we got this information.
Yeah, those were forbidden texts. So exactly. You couldn't just look that up in the dictionary you bought from the grocery store. Yeah,
The book goes back many centuries. You know, go back to the Gutenberg Bible, the actual bound text. So you get an old book. It has this sort of mystique about it. It's an ancient technology. I find it... if we go to a little bit more modern, I watched the Evil Dead movies, and there are evil words that come off of a reel-to-reel tape player, which aren't used anymore, and they were kind of moribund by the time I was a young child.
Yeah, yeah, but it's still got this kind of a level of antiquity to it. Yeah.
Old. I've now lived long enough that an Apple IIe... is now a satanic object.
Yeah.
Like, that is an ancient thing that has forbidden knowledge hidden inside of it.
It's like, it happened, A cassette. A Betamax is as fuck.
It really kind of like broke my brain a little bit when I saw the American version of The Ring. It's about a cursed video cassette.
Yeah.
It's like, I got those.
Oh, the movie, the one that really is Rings, the more recent one that they came out with, they tried to reboot it, literally opens with a guy at like a yard sale or like a rummage sale or a flea market. And he's with his, like, younger girlfriend, and he finds a VHS cassette, and he has to explain to her what it is.
Yeah.
And I'm like, really?
I think kids know what that is.
Yeah, but, I know. I could identify. When I was a kid, I could identify an 8-track. Yeah. I couldn't tell you how it worked, but I understood what it was.
Just plug it right in. It sticks out of the player. You can even see the label while it's playing.
Boom.
That was the advantage of an 8-track. You could always see what's in your player.
Ah, that was the most important thing. I'm so glad they prioritized
that. How many tracks were on an 8-track?
9?
Yes, exactly. Okay. 9.
What if they're long? What if they're like 5-minute tracks? Or they can they always? It's always 8, no matter how long
actually,
the song is.
Actually, no.
Could they fit in 12 if they were really short?
I don't know the standard running time of an 8-track tape because okay. I never tinkered with them. I just had audio cassettes. That was my tech. And my tech is now ancient tech for this generation.
Yeah, it's fun.
I'm eager to see the first movie about a cursed flip phone or a cursed smartphone.
Yeah, cursed BlackBerry.
Yeah, oh, there you go.
Yeah, it's coming up. It's James Wan's BlackBerry.
Oh. You don't understand. When you push the buttons, it eats your thumbs. Or we're going to get to... I don't know. It's some obscure thing. The Bic for Her, the Killer Pens.
What?
Killer Quibi. What are they like?
Oh my God!
Failed technology.
Quibi would be a great thing to be like. You don't understand.
We had to stop Quibi.
Yeah.
It was unhealthy. It was killing people.
Back in 2020, there was briefly a thing called Quibi. It was the most cursed streaming service we ever constructed. What's a streaming service? I'm glad you asked, Bartleby. In the 2010s and 2020s, humans had a brief dalliance with streaming services before they realized that physical media was always the best way to go. Oh, that sounds scary. It was. You never knew where you could watch True Lies. We're off on a tangent. Here's the deal. The Cellar is... It's interesting because Choose or Die, you argue that it's like not good, but it's still kind of weird. It's kind of an odd duck film.
Yeah.
Here it's well constructed, but it's not interesting.
So I think we have two halves of the same coin. No, yeah. They're bad in different ways.
Maybe I was a little kinder to Choose or Die because I watched that second in the same day.
Oh, I suppose so.
Because The Cellar was just... The Cellar was a bit of a snooze. Like, there's a couple of good bits early on, and then it just lost me really fast.
What I appreciate, Choose or Die has some interesting gore moments. It has a stupid conceit. The more we learn about what this evil game is up to and what it can do to you and why it was brought into being, it just gets dumber.
Yeah.
And... Never once was I frightened or disturbed by the gore.
There's one bit with glass that kind of freaked me out.
A bit with glass, because it goes a little slow.
Yeah.
There are moments in The Cellar that are frightening. Okay. They actually bothered to set things up in a scary way, and there's like some spooky visuals, and the way the house looks is pretty cool. I think there's a lot of cool visual stuff in it that make it feel like an actual horror movie. Right. It's actually bothering to try to scare me, even though... I know what a Satan movie is, guys. I heard an Iron Maiden song once. I'm there.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So I'm a little bit kinder to The Cellar because it actually does what a horror movie's supposed to do, and that's scary a little bit.
All right. Well, one last thing we want to talk about this week on Critically Acclaimed is a movie that has actually been re-released to theaters, which they're doing more often now. They recently re-released The Godfather.
Yeah.
Into like actual like not just like one night only in your locals like whatever. It's like no, like in theaters. You can just watch The Godfather.
Like Fathom Events.
Yeah, that's pretty cool actually. And they decided to clean up and re-release David Lynch's most recent feature film, which came out way back in 2006. It is called Inland Empire. It stars Laura Dern as
many different characters.
Well, the way that David Lynch described this movie and. This is one of those David Lynch movies where explaining the plot's a little tricky. David Lynch described it as a woman in trouble.
Well,
That's the whole plot. Yeah. She plays a woman in trouble, and boy is she.
He described Eraserhead. What is Eraserhead? What is it about? It's a dream of dark and troubling things. Things, yeah, that's descriptive. A woman in trouble, as Inland Empire. This is a boldly experimental movie that David Lynch put together as he went along.
Yeah,
the idea was there is a little bit of a story where Jeremy Irons plays a film director who's making a movie called On High
in Blue
in
Tomorrows.
Blue Tomorrows.
Yeah.
And
it is a remake of a movie that was famously never finished because allegedly the production was cursed.
And yeah, so he's trying to remake it. And so there's this idea that this production may also be cursed.
Laura Dern plays an actress who is cast in the film, and over the course of the movie, her connection to reality begins to waver.
Yeah, she kind of What Jeremy, the language Jeremy Irons uses is, it was, the previous production was cursed because they found something inside the story.
Mm.
It's very, very ominous. Yeah. And, yeah, Laura Dern plays the lead actress. She's playing Laura Dern, more or less.
Yeah.
And she kind of vanishes into not just the movie, but a lot of different movies simultaneously.
Yeah.
And the way it worked is David Lynch would call up Laura Dern and say, hey, come over to my house. I have an idea. And she'd come over. It's like, what should I wear? Just wear a blue dress. And I'm going to have you, like, climb through the woods at night. And I'm just going to film you doing that. And, okay, what is... And Laura Dern, totally game, just says, yeah. Okay, I'm going to do this. Now we're going to go and you're going to be a Polish sex worker in this scene. And I want you to sort of like read some of these lines, but you can also improvise a little bit. And we're going to film that scene where you're a Polish sex worker being interrogated and talking about your horrible life. And over the course of all of these experiments, and they were not connected in David Lynch's mind. He's just filming these things that sort of came to him. These ideas would come to him.
Kind of stream of consciousness.
This was about the time when he was first started getting into like meditation, like transcendental meditation.
Oh no, he'd been into that bit for a while actually.
Well, he was publishing his book around the time in Inland Empire.
I'm just saying he'd been doing it for a bit. Yeah.
But he talked a lot about, when he talks about transcendental meditation, about how it's a way to sort of tap into like Plato's realm of ideas. That's where ideas are coming from. So it was like really kind of opening his mind in new ways. And he was really high on it for a while. He doesn't talk about it so much anymore. And then at the end of that, he assembled all of these little shorts. And what emerged from this weird... And he also included a couple shorts that he had shot for his website. There's a sitcom with rabbit characters.
Yeah.
That was something that was pre-existing that he worked its way into Inland Empire.
And it's really creepy and weird.
Yeah.
It's really creepy and weird.
He said in interviews that he really likes sawing pine. So there's scenes of a guy sawing a log, because that's what David Lynch would do for his own edification.
For amusement, yeah.
This also came at a time when he was really trying to get into digital filmmaking and had pretty much turned his back on celluloid.
Yeah.
He said it looked good, but if you watch the documentary Side by Side, the one with Keanu Reeves, he talks about how cinema is a dinosaur. You have to wait all this time to see these dailies, and you have to shoot it in a certain way. And by the time you get back the scene you shot, you've already had four more ideas, and ahead of what the production is.
When you had to spend your entire career shooting and then waiting days to get the dailies back, and then you have to like a lot of older filmmakers were very eager to move into digital because finally we can just get this fucking thing going.
It was super easy. And this was in 2006.
They're willing to sacrifice elements of an aesthetic in order to move on.
So yeah, when he made Inland Empire, it was 2006, and he was working with essentially just consumer-grade digital cameras. Really low quality visuals.
And yet he makes this movie, which is, again, very minimal lighting in a lot of it. It's stuff you could do at home. David Lynch has such an eye for the discomforting that he can take consumer-grade cameras and throw something together at a house in an afternoon that looks unbelievably professional. Like, he is very particular. He's getting exactly an effect that he wants to. This doesn't look cheap just because it's shot on the cheap.
Yeah.
Like, it looks very particular. Mm. It's very frightening. It's very discomforting.
It has that kind of that found footage horror quality too, which was hip at the time. And I think that had a lot to do with the camera technology at the time. But yeah, what eventually emerged was a story about how much David Lynch admires not just Laura Dern, but actors in general, but Laura Dern in particular.
Yeah,
and how their ability to swallow their own identities to the service of an art is depicted in Inland Empire as this kind of blood sacrifice that they're making of themselves.
Yeah.
And yeah,
it's basically losing your soul and replacing it with someone else's for a while.
If you look at Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive, you can see that David Lynch is preoccupied with the idea of identity and what it means to have that eye erased or replaced with something else. And that, what does an actor do but replace their own identity as a job, like on a daily basis? So I think this is a poem to actors.
Yeah.
That's how I see Inland Empire.
I don't think you're wrong. I don't. I think one of the beauties of a film like Inland Empire is that you can have that perspective and someone else could have an entirely different perspective, and you can focus on the movie within the movie as maybe the true narrative here, and is a story about trauma and sex work.
Or you can see it as something like straight up supernatural.
Yeah,
like
it's just a story of a haunted movie script, basically. And it works on that level. If you want to just focus it on that, it's about a movie that's making the actors in it lose their mind. It could work actually on a plot level if you really, really wanted it to. You can look at it as a story about relationships dissolving and how, you know, she's married and she might be having an affair with her co-star, but maybe they're not. Maybe it's all in her head. Maybe it's all a matter of obsession. Maybe it is a story about someone who is desperately trying to get ahead in the industry and destroying themselves in the process. But rather than seem unfocused, which, you know, complaint I've lobbied at some other films this week, this feels like all of those interpretations have been given equal validity.
And because David Lynch is taking the time to give all of those voice. And this is a long film. It's three hours in length.
Yeah.
Which is going to be a tough sit for something as, like, bizarre and experimental as this.
Yeah, this might... I'll say this. Depending on your patience for non-linear, experimental storytelling techniques, you might feel the length on this one. You might say to yourself, okay, this is getting a little long. I can appreciate that. If on the other hand you find yourself on the film's wavelength, it's like binging the new Twin Peaks. It's like a lot of it's just weird for its own sake, and you assume this will work out later. Maybe it won't. Maybe at the end you just saw a bunch of really fascinating shit, and that's okay too. Sometimes that's all a dream is. You don't necessarily come out of the dream going, well, I know what that means, and that means, and that means, and that means. And sometimes it's just weird shit your brain came up with while you were comatose for 8 hours.
I love that. Eddie Izzard has a funny bit about dreams. It's like when you tell somebody your dream to a psychiatrist and they interpret your dreams. What does the dream mean?
Stop that.
My phone is buzzing. He says, yes, I had, and her bit is, I had this dream, and I dreamed that I saw a marsh, and their heads explode, and their buttocks explode, and they gave me some jam, and they said, and the psychiatrist said, you didn't get on with your father. Like, wait, what? What is that? That the buttocks exploding sort of thing?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
David Lynch has always very, very staunchly refused to talk about his films because what he wants to say is what he said. That's what's in the movie.
The whole idea of if you're confused by it or you have your interpretation, that's the point. I'm reminded of these. It's kind of like when people say like, yes, well, what really happened at the end of Inception? Was it all, was he still in a dream or was he in the real world? And I'll tell you the secret to that right now. We don't know.
The point is we don't know.
The point
is left ambiguous.
The point is it's left ambiguous on purpose. Your mind wants to fill in that gap and make a choice. And that says something about you. That's the interactive part of the cinema, where you get to be intellectually, emotionally, psychologically engaged with the piece and come to your own conclusion. That's what's exciting about it. David Lynch works like that, but instead of just doing it like right in the last scene, it's every single second of the film, and that can be incredibly engaging if you're in the mood for it. And if you're that's not your type of filmmaking, it might be really, really weird, but I do recommend you check it out. Maybe Inland Empire isn't the best place to start with David Lynch because it is such a lengthy tome. Maybe something like Lost Highway or Blue Velvet might be, or Mulholland Drive might be a better start.
But this is
big, epic, complex David Lynch. And if that sounds good to you and you never had a chance to see it and you never had a chance to see it on the big screen, do it while you can.
I get off on lengthy, difficult movies. That's sort of a bit of my jam. So I really like Inland Empire. There is a moment in this film, just like a straight up horror movie moment, where we get a really terrifying close up of Laura Dern's face.
It's
distorted. And I'm guessing this is something, and it goes to sort of like insecurities about your own looks, but it's, you know, presented as really terrifying, and it's a still image. And I remember when that shot came up in the movie theater, because I saw this when it first came out in 2006, and it was one of those moments where I stare at it for a few minutes before I start screaming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even at home, even at home, by the time that comes up, yeah, even a movie as strange as Inland Empire has kind of lulled you into a sense of like, well, this is what the movie is. And even though that shot has been used in a lot of stills, you're not ready for it when it comes up.
Yeah, you really
based on the context of the scene and the pacing of it, and it's just the
sound effects that go with it. Yeah,
it's just the most frightening image. It's not a frightening image by itself. You might say to yourself, "Well, that's a disturbing image." But if you watch the whole film and then that scene just happens to come up when it does, it's the fucking freakiest thing. And God, David Lynch knows how to get you. He really does. I almost wish he had tried just once to do a horror movie. Like, just to try it.
Lost Highway is kind of a horror movie. Eraserhead's a horror movie. I would say Eraserhead's a horror movie.
Eraserhead
it's really scary anyway.
It's scary. But I guess what I mean is semi-conventional horror movie. Like, I'd be curious to see what he...
killing each other.
Yeah, we saw what he did with sci-fi with Dune. Mm-hmm. He had plenty of downtime between movies. He could have cranked out a horror movie in the 90s. Why not?
He still could. David Lynch has... he retired from filmmaking after Inland Empire.
Yeah. He went back to TV and did Twin Peaks.
He did Twin Peaks. And the contingency was just do what you want.
Yeah.
Really, whatever. As long as you want. Yeah, yeah.
He did not follow any kind of pre-existing template for the Twin Peaks The Return. That's for goddamn sure.
What I'm kind of surprised is that Twin Peaks The Return wasn't rejected.
Yeah.
I would think that you're going back and David Lynch just sort of doing what he wanted would upset people who had gotten used to like those characters in certain scenarios.
Much like Fire Walk With Me. Yeah. But no, I think at that point, everyone was just sort of like, I don't know what
it was kind of the antidote
to a lot of television.
Yeah.
It was kind of nothing like it. Everyone was just like, well, let's do this. Let's try it. And the fact that that show was successful and like embraced actually is very encouraging, I feel. And I feel like there's actually room for a lot of experimental shit to maybe find more of an audience now. Now that it can just be clicked on in streaming or on your DVR rather than having to go and seek it out at like art houses at midnight. As much as I love that aesthetic, as much as I love that presentation, I think a lot of people are more willing to give stuff a chance if they just have to click on it at home. And they might find they really like it. So I realize that's a bit ironic because Inland Empire is now in theaters. But yeah, definitely make sure you check it out. Hopefully it has like a decent home video release of this new upscaled version.
Yeah.
Well, cleaned up a bit.
The Criterion Collection has put out several of David Lynch's movies in the past. And if they clean up Inland Empire, I'd be interested in getting that.
I think it's a Janus restoration. So we'll go.
Okay, so yeah, then we're probably going to get a Criterion Blu-ray at some point.
I sure as hell hope so. Yeah. But anyway, that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Let's review some movies on our Critically Acclaimed scale. Once again, we review films on a scale of C- to C+. Most films are a C. That is some good, some bad, all mediocre. Might work better for some audiences than others. You know, average. C- is below average. That's any movie we don't recommend. Any movie that doesn't really work, kind of rubs us the wrong way, or we think is absolutely awful. That's a C-. Anything in that range. And C+ is anything that's above average. We genuinely recommend it. We think it's quite good. We think it's the best thing ever. Anything in that range? C+. On that note, Whitney, where do you stand on Inland Empire?
C+. Yeah. I think people ought to see this movie. It is long. It is quite challenging. It's very strange. What are you going to take from it? Let's see.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Watch it and find out. Because there's going to be a lot to sort of read out of a movie like this.
Yeah, I agree. It's a big old C+ for me. It's not my favorite Lynch. I don't even know if it's in my top three. But it's really, really, really good. And and unfortunately, I think it was a little underseen when it initially came out, and it has been not very well available on home video for a really long time.
Yeah, well, it's
so
it's,
take the opportunity.
It wasn't in a lot of theaters. Couldn't get a lot of distribution, mostly because of its length and its content. It's long and it's strange, and you know that's not highly commercial. So I had to go out to the Sunset 5 here in LA. I was the only theater that was playing it in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
didn't play in most cities. Now that it's being re-released, if it's playing in a city near you, please go see it on the big screen. Really get trap yourself in. Understand that there's going to be a lot of sort of down, kind of sleepy moments in this movie. and then it's going to grab you by the nose and it's going to shake you about around a bit. So it's really, really terrifying. It's really, really good.
All right, moving on. The new Shudder horror film, The Cellar. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give this film a very high C-. There's a level of competency here that I cannot deny, but in service of what? Nothing really interesting. Yeah, I can't get past that, unfortunately.
I'm going to give it a C, just because I think it actually, because it did actually scare me.
Yeah.
It frightened me in certain moments. And I think the visuals are really strong. I think the pacing, the editing, and the sound design are all really, really great. It's just the basic idea and the script are super mediocre.
Yeah.
Like, it's like not even down the middle. It's like below the middle. And
That's why I give it a C-.
If they put some like creativity or some more interesting thought into it, it could have been a classic.
Yeah.
With this style. And I feel like this filmmaker has shown a lot of promise. So I'm looking forward to what they do next.
Absolutely. Next up is Choose or Die, which I was struggling with what I was going to rate this, and I'm just going to go with my gut. I had a good time.
Okay.
I'm going to give it a very low C+.
Oh my God.
It is a fun, silly horror movie. I feel like when you go back to something like, when you look at the movies that are released by Shout Factory or Scream Factory, some of them are absolute classics, and some of them are just weird stuff, and you can't believe they got a Blu-ray release, and like, oh, I thank God I saw Evil Speak, or something like...
976 Evil.
Yeah, just something like that, where it's just like, you watch it, it's actually like, it knows it's kind of stupid, but you had a good time watching it, and what more could you possibly ask for something with this premise? I'm at that point with Choose or Die. I'm like, I'm not sure what more I could have really have asked for from it. I had a good time, fun, memorable set pieces. I like the characters. I'll give it a pass.
All right. I'm going to give a C-.
Ah!
I don't like this movie. I think it's dumb. if I'm thinking of movies like Fear.com and Friend Request and 976 Evil, you're not in a good realm. This is that was never really that type of hipster techno horror has never survived very well. Never availed itself too well.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if any of them have. Like, Ghost in the Machine wasn't very good. Scream was kind of techno horror. The cell phone was new at the time. Now it's so ubiquitous we don't think of it that way.
I think the one that really succeeded is something like David Lynch or David Cronenberg's Videodrome.
Well, yeah.
Which, you know, he does a lot of tech or Existenz. That's a video game based horror.
Yeah, and Videodrome was about like pirate television back in the 80s when that was an actual thing.
Yeah, like Betamax cassettes or like these evil, squishy organic things that you insert in somebody's abdomen.
It's no Videodrome, but I did enjoy it.
Yeah, I think Videodrome works, but yeah, for the most part, okay, I see what you're doing here. We're afraid of old tech. There's something hidden in it.
Yeah.
If you're going to do that, do it right.
Yeah.
Make it scary. Make it more fun than this.
I had enough fun to justify, but I see your point. And then lastly, Fantastic Beasts. The Secrets of Dumbledore.
Yeah.
It's a big old C-.
Yeah, these movies are all pretty, are just solidly C-minus movies.
Yeah.
Because they're not telling the story well, and they don't know what they're doing with these movies, or what kind of wonderment we're supposed to be getting out of these movies.
Yeah, I'll give a little bit of credit to Dan Fogler in particular. I think Dan Fogler is really bringing it in all these. Mads Mikkelsen is absolutely doing his job, and I do want to give a credit, especially if this is like the last we ever see him. I think Newt Scamander was an interesting idea for a hero. I wish he'd been allowed to star in his own movies.
You know what I wish what he'd been allowed
to like have his story told instead of get wrapped up in all this other shit.
I would love to see Newt Scamander in a live action 30-minute TV series.
Like almost like a Discovery Channel series where he just goes and finds different magical beasts.
Yeah, sort of the suit, not necessarily a documentary style, but you know, it's about him finding a beast.
Yeah,
and he learns something weird about a beast.
That's kind of. I mean, I don't mean.
And Dan Fogler is his sidekick. That he
I don't mean to project and give a movie demerits for not being what I wanted, but that's kind of what they suggested it would be.
And wasn't
based,
it too?
And based on what we actually got, which wasn't better than that, I kind of wish they'd done that. Make it actually about some, you know, fantastic beasts. Maybe go find them rather than. Wizard presidents. Okay, moving on. Anyway, that is it for critically acclaimed. Next week, we might not have a critically acclaimed because I'm actually going out of town for a little bit. We're going to pre-record some stuff to air on the network, including The Iron List, a few other things as well. So there will be content on the Patreon page and the main channel, but probably not a new critically acclaimed because I won't have time to see any new movies before I go. But I won't be gone very, very long, and we should be back up and running pretty quick afterwards. Yeah. So just a heads up about that. But to everyone who subscribes, everyone who's on our Patreon, there will be new stuff to enjoy in that time. Speaking of which, thank you to all of our patrons, without whom the show would not exist. Patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive shows over there, including one we just added. We have a series called Only the Best, where we review every single film ever nominated for Best Picture, and we've been doing it in chronological order. And as we've been going through the 20s and the 30s, and now we're in the late 1940s, we've run into something different, which is the Academy started to honor Best International Feature under different banners through over the years. So we've decided to add a new podcast to our $5 tier, which is Only the Best International, in which we will review all of the films that initially won, didn't used to be nominees, Best International Feature, and then eventually, when we get there, all the films that were nominated. So, extra episodes, basically, is what you get there, of film film history, isn't it nice? Anyway, we're also on Twitter, at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
If you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode, feel free to send us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Yeah, send us a physical letter. Send it to Newt Scamander.
Don't do that.
Okay. Care of the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Thank you very, very much once again, everybody, for listening. We hope you have a wonderful week. And never forget, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?